Okay, so we're waiting for Doma Tipongo to be on the air, and there's a problem in the newsroom, and so I assume that you're hearing me. Violetta, you hear me, right?
I do hear you loud and clear.
This would be a great place for a radio station. So Doma T's going to finish the news or the traffic or the weather in just a minute, but in the meantime, maybe we'll just get started with the show because we can't hear the newsroom, and I'm not sure the newsroom can hear us. So let's just start it this way, and we'll pick it up from there in a little bit. It's 107 on WGN, and hi, this is John Williams. Not the start we're normally used to, but that's okay. We'll get those bugs worked out here in just a couple of minutes. In the meantime, let's do the show all the way until 3 o'clock. Remember, on social media, I'm WGN King John. We're on Saturdays from 10 a.m. until 12 noon, too. We hope you had a good weekend, and it's a weekend that a lot of people would wish had not happened. Good grief. Maybe all of those people that were marching up Lakeshore Drive on Thursday weren't so crazy after all, right? I mean, think about it. The Chicago Tribune is reporting over 74. In fact, just before we came into the studio today, they said 75 people shot over the weekend, 11 fatally, 63 or 64 now wounded. In one seven-hour period, Madeline Buckley in the Tribune writes, 40 people were shot in a seven-hour period. Ages 11 to 62, almost all in the south and west sides. That's an uptick from the recent trend. It had been going down, you know. And the 1,700 or so that have been shot this year are still fewer than the same time last year or the year before. Even when you include what happened this weekend, our numbers are down in Chicago, which just tells you how bad it was in 2017 and 2016. There have now been 300-plus homicides in Chicago this year, again, down from previous years right now. But again, 74 shot, maybe 75, in at least four mass gang shootings. It was one of the deadliest weekends in Chicago in memory. I noticed some of the shootings were close to 3 in the morning, too. Young people being shot at 2:45 and 3 a.m. It's tempting to say, well, you shouldn't be out at 3 a.m. on the south or west side, and maybe you shouldn't be, but that's akin to telling abused women not to wear pretty clothes. It shouldn't happen under any circumstances. The Tribune has an interactive map online right now that shows where each of the shootings and homicides occurred, and they have posted separately about each of the last 78 shootings. Over the last 4 days, 78 different posts. Specifically, they write in Chicago, 1,785 people have been shot this year, which is, get a load of this, 480 fewer than in 2017. One other set of stats for you. So far this year, more than 5,500 illegal guns have been confiscated off the streets of Chicago. And at Stroger County Hospital over the weekend, as many as 200. At Stroger County, as many as 200 people at one point had gathered in the emergency room area. And briefly at Mount Sinai, they stopped accepting emergency cases because they were full up and didn't have room for any more. So Rudy Giuliani over the weekend, in four separate tweets, totaling five specific spelling and numerical errors, threw some shade on our city and tried to bolster the campaign for Gary McCarthy for mayor. When he called Gary McCarthy the political genius, he named him Jerry McCarthy. And then he tweeted, let's get on board for Jerry McCarthy. And then he misspelled McCarthy's, spelling McCarthy's name correctly, he tweeted, he can do better than Mayor Emanuel, but misspelled Emanuel. Finally, he tweeted one more time, again misspelling Emanuel and incorrectly saying that there were 63 murders this weekend. It was an insanely violent weekend on the south and west side. 74 shot. 11 were shot dead, 63 were injured, 63 were not murdered. I don't know why he brings this up. Maybe it's because distraction, distraction, distraction seems to be the MO for the president and now his attorney sometimes. Or maybe they just figure anything bad for Chicago is good for Trump. They seem to believe that. I wonder if those inaccuracies in the Giuliani tweets bother you. But I also wonder if it just helps or hurts Gary McCarthy. If you're Gary McCarthy and you want to be mayor of Chicago, Chicago, a Democratic stronghold, does Giuliani tweeting on your behalf the calling you a political genius, but also misspelling your name. So really, how much does Giuliani know about Gary McCarthy anyway? I wonder if Giuliani tweeting on your behalf is helpful or hurtful to your campaign. That's not a rhetorical question. I mean, you think, hey, if the president or the president's attorney's on your side, and they love to endorse and champion candidates and causes, you'd think you'd take that, but I don't know that you would if you're Gary McCarthy. And how do they not know that, right? So if you're Giuliani and or Trump, and you say, okay, we want Gary McCarthy to be the next mayor of Chicago, then do you tweet that out or not? Because, go ahead, Steve. There you are, Steve. Now we hear Steve. I'm going to turn Steve off, Griffin, just for a second, because it sounds like he doesn't know that he was just on the air. But the question is, does, you know, the Trump team realize that this is not if, in fact, you want Gary McCarthy to be mayor, does that help or hurt you or his campaign when you guys specifically tweet out on his behalf? Oh, and finally, where is Jenny McCarthy from? You've got Gary McCarthy, Jerry McCarthy, and I just thought we'd mention that Jenny McCarthy is also from the Chicago area, in case you didn't know.
Didn't she used to date Urlacher?
I'm trying to think of what her who her dating and married life was. She was with, Griffin's probably better at this sort of thing than I am, but Jim Carrey.
Jim Carrey was in the mix at one
Jim
point.
Carrey was her guy for a while. It's kind of interesting, is this a tangent, but Jenny McCarthy, here's her wiki, credited as Jenny McCarthy and Jenny Wahlberg, is an American actress, model, television host, author, screenwriter, and anti-vaccine activist.
Yeah, she did date Brian Urlacher. They split up August 16th, 2012, reported by People.
Okay, so
that's coming up. The anniversary is coming up.
So we are sort of we're covering a lot of ground here, but that's just a little tangent. That's a little left turn we took. Jenny says, "I am not an anti-vaccine activist. I'm not sure what you are, but once it's on your wiki page, it's official." So back to Gary McCarthy and Rudy Giuliani, or what happened in Chicago over the weekend. I like the first observation, maybe best. Maybe those people marching up Lakeshore Drive last Thursday, or really on Belmont and Clark, weren't so crazy after all, right? My number is 312-591-7200. You can call or text that number. I'd like to know what you're thinking about all of this weekend and the Giuliani tweets, which really are Chicago tweets, next on WGN. Got some White Sox tickets to give away between now and the top of the hour. It's 1:19 on WGN, so you've got a chance to win White Sox tickets for a game next weekend. Yankees in town tonight, of course. Hopeful that they're going to be able to play. The rain is coming and going. But we've got 7 o'clock tip-offs, 7:10 tonight, tomorrow night, and Wednesday against the somewhat struggling Yankees. Fran, you're on WGN Radio. This is John Williams. What can I do for you?
Hi. Well, you touched on a problem that I keep yelling at the radio about every time I hear that a 14-year-old or an 11-year-old or somebody's out at midnight or 2 o'clock in the morning or 3:30, and I'm like, I realize I'm a white person living in a suburb. My life is so different. But as a mom, you know, where are these kids' mothers or guardians that let them go out? And I say let them, you know. I mean, I know sometimes their will is stronger than yours, but it drives me crazy. And I'm yelling at the TV or I'm yelling at the radio going, what the heck are you doing out at that time of the night? You know, that's what bothers me so much. I realize people are out all the time. And if they're adults, okay. But what are the kids doing out in the middle of the night? That's what really bothers me.
Yeah. I got to tell you, I hear what you're saying. There's a little echo on the line, so I'm going to hang up on you, Karen. But thank you for the call. I wonder the same thing myself, and I know you do, too. You hear about these shootings. Look, I was going through the 78 separate posts that the Tribune has up from the weekend. I know that's more than the number that they say were actually shot, 74. I went back to, I think, August 2nd or 3rd, and I counted 78 different posts about shootings. And sometimes they're 2:30 or 3 in the morning, and sometimes it's an 11-year-old or a 15-year-old. But say it was a 50-year-old. If I lived on the South or West Side, and I and I wanted to live to see tomorrow, I think I would say, it sucks that my life is such that I can't go out when I want to in my own neighborhood, but I can't and I won't. And if I had a kid like that, I think I'd lock the door if I thought they were going to get out. How is your 11-year-old out at 2:45 in the morning on the South or West Side? Now, here's what that ignores, right? Kids being out late isn't the problem. Bullets are the problem. So I understand the, you know, flaw in that thinking. That doesn't solve the problem, but it maybe keeps your kid alive to see tomorrow. And I wonder the same thing, too. Now, who are the parents and what are the conditions in which all of those people are living? That's a whole nother conversation. But yeah, I know what you're saying. Karen's on line one. You're on WGN. Hi, Karen. What did you want to say?
Hi, I am appalled again, and we all shake our head about this that happened. And I very rarely agree with the mayor of Chicago, Rahm Emanuel. But when he says values, that's what it's about. And he's going to take a big hit for that because, you know, the different little groups of African American leaders are going to turn on him now. And, you know, back and forth we're going to go, and we'll be sad for less than 2 days because that seems to be the way that it goes. And then we'll have a prayer vigil, I should say, and then we'll have more wringing of hands, and then nothing gets done. Yeah. Now, it has to be responsibility, and it has to be the responsibility of the people that live in this community. Every time you see only women, I don't know where the men are hiding, all right? A man is a man. Step up. You see women with tattoos. You see the food trucks coming around to feed the children. Tattoos cost money, John. So, you know, somewhere I read $51,000 is what is given out in different forms of aid. All right, and now we're going to see the pink backpacks come out for school. You have to get your kid to school. You can't just demand the job. You can't have the six-figure salary without being educated and showing up.
All right, hold on, Karen, hold on. I know you're on a rant, and I feel your pain.
I know you're frustrated. I'm sorry.
I appreciate your call. I'm going to let you go. We hear you loud and clear. Rick is next. You're on WGN. Rick, are you there, Rick? You're on the air.
Yeah, John, how you doing?
Talk to me. You're on the air.
Okay. It's not a gun problem. The police chief of Chicago, of Cook County, actually said it when the officer Bauer was shot and killed in the Thompson Center. You could tell a frustration in his voice. These judges get these convicted felons that are caught with guns on them in front of them in their courtrooms, and they're back out on the streets in 6 months. These guys need to go into prison, get locked up for 10 years, get the worst of the criminals off the street. If you have to build more prisons to get the worst of the worst off the street, they need to. I mean, there's a lot of low-level offenders that are locked up in jail because they can't afford to get attorneys to get out, but yet we let these convicted felons run around the streets of Chicago with handguns.
I appreciate your phone call, Rick. That's Rick on line two. We're going from you, sir, to John on line three. You're on WGN. John, jump in there. What do you want to say?
Hey, John, I'm a former social worker, and I've been watching the situation for years. I've got an idea that I think is really practical, but I think could work. To me, the core need, the core issue is getting community involvement in the neighborhood where the issues are taking place. We can have police, we can have all kinds of social service, but we have to have the rank and file, the people that live in those neighborhoods who have ownership, to be the people that are leading the charge. And we need leaders in those neighborhoods. My idea is called community resource teams. Every neighborhood where of need in the city would have a resource team in their local grade school. So you could, that would be the location, the meeting place. And then I think people feel disconnected from the city. They feel, you know, they feel isolated. And what needs to happen is for the city, I call it a resource team leader, have a police officer, have a social worker, whatever, all the agencies, churches, meet in these schools weekly if you need to do weekly, monthly, whatever. But the big need is to get community people to come, yeah, to feel connected to the city.
No, I get it. And, you know, listen, you're a social worker, so you know more about this than I do. You know, one of these was a block party. One of these shootings took place at a block party. A couple cars pulled up, a couple kids got out, and they started shooting into the block party. And I'm thinking, that's what you want to do. You want to have block parties. You want to say, we're going to take back the night. We're all going to gather together. We're going to establish community. And then they just spray bullets into the block party. How frustrating is that if you're trying to sort of say, okay, I'm going to put my money where my mouth is. I'm going to, you know, stand where I say people should be. I'll be one of them out in harm's way. We will act like a community here. And then the bullets start flying. I appreciate your phone call. We're going to David next. You're on WGN. David, this is John. You're on the air.
Good afternoon, sir. I'm reluctantly calling in because, you know, the responders and calls so far, everybody's got their own opinion. And I'm not a white person. I'm an African-American. And this is the problem. You've got multi-generational poverty in the South and West Sides, and that has been compounded by a lack of two things, jobs and education, education and jobs. They go hand in hand, sir. And so I've been in Chicago over 40 years now. I'm not from Chicago originally. And I have seen, and we've all seen, jobs leave the inner city, and they're not replaced. And consequently, there are no jobs for the dads and or moms to go to. Not meaningful jobs, not middle-class jobs.
Yeah.
And as a consequence, the property taxes then decline, which means the schools decline. So it's a self-reinforcing cycle is what it is. And until folks want to address, you know, the institutional racism that revolves around not investing in those communities and the companies not willing to locate in those communities, all we're doing is blowing hot air. And it's tragic, this loss of life. And all due respect, don't take this the wrong way. If these were white people getting killed all the time like this, it'd be a whole different conversation.
You imagine?
I'm tired.
Yeah.
I'm sick of hearing about it. I just am. It's, imagine. Same number of white folks were killed any other place. Oh, my God. It'd be a huge conversation. They'd do something about it. We haven't talked about guns, because, you know, obviously the guns are a big part of it. But it's the value of life. White America doesn't value black Americans' lives as much as they value white American lives. Take that as you want to, but that's just reality. So invest in the communities. Elect good leaders, maybe it'll start turning around, but it's not going to happen on a dime. It's like a big old ship. It takes a long time to turn around. And that's my input.
Appreciate you listening, David. Thanks for the phone call. 128, Steve Bertrand's in the WGN Radio Newsroom. I believe I am the most interested host on Chicago radio in the water temperature. That doesn't make me the most interesting host, but I'm the most interested host in the water temperature in the lake every day. 78. I mean,
can you feel the difference?
Yes, you can. Yes, you so can. Particularly since the beaches are pretty shallow for quite a distance. If you're at Montrose, you can go 50, 75 yards out and the water's still 4.5, 5 feet deep. There's a sandbar halfway out, so you'll be up to your knees and that's it, and you're way out there. Those shallower waters get warm, but then you'll be going along, and all of a sudden, boom, it's very cold in some spots.
It's not always the shallow water that warms up the water.
Ew.
I've thought about that a little bit, Steve, when I'm out there, and I think, well, it's a big lake.
It's a really big lake.
And there's fish, and it's not like they go into the outhouse.
I've never seen a porta-potty for a fish.
So let's wrap up the news, then. It's 1:38 on WGN. Did you do the closeout, Steve?
We're all done. I did it. We're done.
Before 2 o'clock, we're giving away tickets to the White Sox game. We've got tickets for the White Sox next weekend. The Indians will be in town Saturday the 11th. You want some White Sox tickets? You bet you do. White Sox radio tonight, 7:10. Tomorrow night, 7:10. Next night, 7:10. First pitch as the Yankees are in town. Also in town this weekend and tonight, via the Gene Siskel Film Center, a movie about Dick Cavett and Muhammad Ali. The filmmaker is an archivist and a sometimes documentary filmmaker named Robert Bader. and he's sitting right next to me. Robert, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Welcome back to WGN Radio.
Yes, I've been on here before.
With Nick DiGilio.
Yeah, I had a book about the Marx Brothers that Nick did a piece on with me a couple of years ago.
Well, okay, let's just start there for a second. What should I know or remember about the Marx Brothers?
Well, the book was about their early days in vaudeville, which hadn't really been covered anywhere else, so that was my mission to do that book, because I wanted to discuss the stuff that nobody knew about. So it's a book about the Marx Brothers with mostly stuff you didn't know.
Do they hold up, the Marx Brothers?
Oh, I think so. I think there's something about them that's timeless. Other comedy teams from those days are kind of forgotten, but Duck Soup works for every generation because there are always going to be people who want to make fun of war.
I don't remember. Was that it? Was that their niche?
I think Duck Soup was, yeah.
Make fun of war?
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
Well, Duck Soup is about these two fictional countries that go to war over the president insulting the president. And it just is made to be so silly.
Well, how would that resonate today? Nothing like that's
nothing,
currently
nothing
happening.
At all. Oh. It resonated in the 60s during the Vietnam War, and the Marx Brothers had a huge comeback.
Oh, no kidding. You know, it's funny, though, because every now and then, I don't remember the last time I watched a Marx Brothers film all the way through. I don't know that I, in fact, ever have. But I'll say this, whenever I do find Marx Brothers clips one way or another, I do think Groucho and the gang are very funny. I think he was a good actor, a good comedic actor.
Yeah, they actually had something unique. They were four very different guys when they were the four Marx Brothers, and they worked on stage together for 25 years before they even made movies.
Got it.
And they just had something very different than the others, and they just still seem really funny. Their lesser movies are still great.
All right, let's not dwell on this. What's the name of that movie, though?
Which one, the Marx Brothers movie or my movie?
Your movie.
Ali and Cavett, The Tale of the Tapes.
No, the one you did about the Marx Brothers.
Oh, no, your book about the Marx Brothers. That's Four of the Three Musketeers, the Marx Brothers on stage. Don't try to confuse me.
That just sounded like a Marx Brothers routine, just so you guys know.
We'll edit this out. It'll never hit the airwaves.
We'll fix it later.
So then tell me why you then, boy, there's a range, so you like that, but you also, and by the way, this is what, the 50th anniversary of the Dick Cavett Show, right?
Yeah, Dick went on for ABC on his daytime show 50 years ago. It was the spring of 1968. The very first guest on the very first show he taped was Muhammad Ali.
So now you've done a documentary film about that, and again, the title of that movie is
Ali and Cavett, The Tale of the Tapes.
I'll give away a pair of tickets to that screening tonight. It's sold out for the Saturday showing, and I believe it may be sold out for tonight. Why was this of interest to you?
Well, I've been working with Dick Cavett's archive for a number of years, and there was always this idea in my head that we could do documentaries based on the stuff in the archive and not have to go too far afield to get other material. And a few years ago, I was the executive producer of two documentaries on PBS, one about the Watergate scandal and one about the Vietnam War, dwelling mostly on the Dick Cavett stuff. So the Ali thing just kind of loomed large in the archive. He was on 14 times, and it was all through that really important decade of his career where he was stripped of his title, refused induction into the Army, had his comeback against Frazier, and then as he stayed in the ring too long and started to deteriorate as a fighter and started to be impaired from blows to the head, and sort of that key component in Ali's story was discussed at every phase on the Cavett Show, and yeah, he was personally friendly with Cavett.
Is this a movie then about Dick Cavett or Muhammad Ali?
Well, it's sort of both, but it's sort of, the way I like to describe it is it's Ali's story through the prism of his interviews and his friendship with Dick Cavett.
When I think of Ali being friendly with the media, I think of Howard Cosell.
Yeah, I don't think Ali ever spent the night at Howard Cosell's house, though. They were really good friends. Cosell was very good to Ali. He was one of the first media people to take Ali's side and defend his position and his right to be a conscientious objector.
Cosell was a type A, bombastic character and caricature, and you think he knew that. You sort of feel the same way about Ali. You don't feel that way about Dick Cavett, though. Cavett was more reserved, right?
Yeah, I think Cosell saw in Ali a great way to promote himself. And I think it was a little different for Dick. And, you know, Dick likes to make the comment, and since he's not here, I'll steal his line. Of course, Ali and I are friends. We came from such similar backgrounds.
Dick Cavett was just in town, though. He's 80-some years old.
He's 81. Right? He'll be 82 in November. He actually is flying home as we do this. He was at the screening last night at the Siskel Center. It was great. We had a real good time there last night.
I wonder if there came a moment when, early on in their relationship, they realized they had something here, the two of them.
you know, as it's shown in the film, they met when Cavett was a writer on the Jerry Lewis Show in 1963, and Cassius Clay came on before his fight with Sonny Liston. So they met in 1963 and didn't have very much contact until Cavett got a show 5 years later. But once Ali was on the Cavett Show and realized it was a place where he was given freedom to say what he wanted to say, as opposed to some other network shows where they wouldn't allow it, it was a place he kept returning to.
What was he saying that the other shows wouldn't?
Well, there's some great stuff in the film where he talks about the corrupt Vietnam War and how America is spending so much money to free people when they can't even free black people in the United States.
Nobody was saying that at the time?
Well, no, plenty of people were saying it at the time, but very few of them were saying it on network television, on talk shows that were supposed to be entertainment shows.
So props to, I guess, Dick Cavett or maybe ABC?
ABC gave him a lot of hell for it, but he did manage to control the content of the show. In fact, that first show that they taped, after it was over, Cavett was so happy that it went so well with Ali, and he had also Gore Vidal on that show, and he went out to the ABC executive in the wings after the taping, thinking he was going to get congratulated, and the guy said, "Nobody gives a damn what Muhammad Ali and Gore Vidal think of the war. We'll air that show tomorrow. We'll air a different one as the first show." And that's what they did.
They didn't run that
they
first
didn't run
interview.
It as the premiere. They ran it the next day because they didn't want it to be the debut of the Dick Cavett Show.
Might have been the death of it out of the gate.
No, well, just the opposite. Apparently the reviews were the first show was okay, but he really hit his stride the second day.
Isn't that funny? Okay, so what was so it wasn't that anybody was saying that. Muhammad Ali was saying it, he wasn't alone.
Sure.
But it was that Dick Cavett was going to tweeze that conversation out and make it presentable on ABC.
Well, to put it in perspective, Ali could probably get a shot to go on a show anytime he wanted to and say what he wanted to. He went on the David Susskind show, and David Susskind was not exactly nice to him and suggested he was a draft dodger, and he never went back. But he went on the Cavett show over and over again.
Cavett didn't push him that way?
No, he challenged him, but he challenged him intelligently, and they discussed it, and it was a conversation rather than an attack.
Yeah. Is there anybody, you know, in the New York Times over the weekend, there was an interview or a feature story about Dick Cavett. They called him, as I said a moment ago, the thinking man's Johnny Carson. And I wonder, in that article, they say he constantly gets asked, who's the Johnny Carson out there today? Is it Jimmy Kimmel? Is it Conan O'Brien? Was it David Letterman? What's your answer to that?
Well, through the fault of no one who's doing these shows today, the landscape is so different. There's no show now that's going to have somebody come on and do an in-depth interview for 90 minutes. And
is that what it was?
Well, sometimes, yes.
Sit down, one guest?
Late night show was 90 minutes, and very often he'd have one guest. Many nights he'd have three or four, but there were occasions where he'd have one guest. Sometimes he'd have, on his PBS show, which was a half an hour, he'd go as many as four half hours with the same guest.
How about Bill Maher?
You know, I don't actually watch it, but
Jon Stewart.
I don't watch that one either. Don't hold that against me.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not a big watcher of these things. I used to watch Letterman, and I think my days as a late-night talk show viewer sort of ended when Letterman went off.
Well, for Maher, I'll just tell you what I know about him, and I'm not a regular watcher of these shows either, but he's intellectual, he's interested in hearing people out, but he's also interested in combat and comedy. And Maher's signature, I think, is outlandishness. And Stewart was obviously very, very funny when he was on, but he had context to what he was saying, but none of them sat back and but those were comedy shows. They are funny shows, even if you didn't like what they said. Sometimes was Dick Cavett's show funny that way?
Well, you know, it could be very funny. He didn't do sketches. I mean, early
he didn't
on,
come out and do a monologue, a funny.
No,
monologue?
He did a monologue, but you know, in his early days on the morning show, they'd occasionally do a comedy sketch, but that didn't seem to really resonate for his audience, so they kind of wiped it out pretty quickly. But the show could be riotously funny, and sometimes when it wasn't supposed to be, there could be some really great interplay. One of the things I love most about the Dick Cavett Show is the mixture of guests. There's a wonderful show, for example, just rattle one off the top of my head, Satchel Paige, Salvador Dali, and Lillian Gish. Together again, folks. You know, but that mixture is great. There's a wonderful show with Groucho and Truman Capote.
Yeah.
And, you know, just to see those people interact was just so unusual.
Wonder if that would work today.
I hope it would. But I don't know.
In our studio, we're talking a little bit about a movie about Muhammad Ali, told through the prism of his interviews with Dick Cavett, and it's showing at the Siskel Film Center tonight.
Tonight,
right?
Yes.
In our studio is Robert Bader. We'll pick it up here in a minute on WGN. We're talking about Dick Cavett and Muhammad Ali with Robert Bader. He's in our studio, and I wanted to give away a pair of tickets. You said you got maybe a pair?
Yeah, we can give away a pair for tonight's screening.
Okay, and so as soon as, you know, let's wait a couple of minutes. I'll tell you when to call. Griff will clear the lines for the White Sox tickets, but if you are at the able to come downtown tonight, at when are you showing, at 7 o'clock?
8 o'clock, actually.
8 o'clock this evening. Are you going to give a talk before or after?
I'm going to be doing a Q&A afterwards, and there's probably a little short introduction. There was last night, so if they run the same program, yes.
What do people ask most about when they talk to you about Muhammad Ali?
Well, the question I get most about when we see the film today is Ali's stand against the Vietnam War. People seem to see a connection to NFL players taking a knee for the national anthem. There's a lot of that, and I hadn't thought of that when I was making it, to be perfectly honest.
No kidding.
But a lot of people ask about that, and I do point out that when Ali did what he did, it was a much riskier thing to do. He didn't have a players' union or anything behind him. He lost everything.
He's self-employed.
Yeah, they took away his title. They took away his license. He couldn't do his job. And I think today it's a little bit more of a protected situation for a professional athlete. And Ali was very brave to do what he did.
Why did he do that?
Well, there's a lot of thought about that, and there are a couple of different perspectives in the movie. He was a member of the Nation of Islam, which was a quite controversial organization at the time, and their policy was not to fight in a war to free people while black people weren't free in this country. And Ali adopted that as a conscientious objector. He kind of messed up his court case as a conscientious objector by saying he would fight in a war to free black people tomorrow, except a conscientious objector has to object to all wars. So it was a complicated time, it was a complicated case, and we do examine that in the film.
Did he go to jail then, or what happened to him as a result?
He was found guilty, but he did not ever go to jail. The Supreme Court did a complicated thing. They overturned their initial decision, and then they kind of vacated their position on it because he had become too old to qualify for the draft while they were deciding it. People don't really think about it that he was more than 26 years old once they decided, so he's
grandfathered out.
No longer eligible for the draft, yeah.
Lucky for him. How did he repair his image then?
You know, that's one of the miraculous things I see in Ali, because it was a very polarizing time, and his position as a member of the Nation of Islam certainly made him a lot of enemies. And he became such a beloved figure, and he never really renounced the Nation of Islam because he had so much respect for Elijah Muhammad, who was a real mentor to him, as was Malcolm X. And when Malcolm X and the Nation of Islam split, he remained loyal to Elijah Muhammad, but he never would say anything bad about Elijah Muhammad. He just backed off the rhetoric a little bit when he got his license back, and Elijah Muhammad censured him and banished him from the Nation of Islam for a year. And Ali continued to believe in Islam. He was a religious man, and he kind of moved over to the conventional version of Islam. And he waited until Elijah Muhammad died in 1975. Ali was one of his pallbearers. And he never really renounced him in any kind of a negative way, because he did respect him quite a bit for how he helped him and what he did for black people in this country who really found an identity there.
The conversation today is complicated because, however people feel about black athletes taking a knee or not taking a knee, so say between the audience and the athletes, you would have that with America and the athlete Muhammad Ali, but you also have the complication today that the president has sort of inserted himself in that dialogue and divided LeBron James and the rest of us. Did Nixon get involved in the Ali story?
Well, actually, when Ali refused induction, Johnson was still president, and he did not comment on it, at least as far as I know, and I think I would have found it if he did. And Nixon stayed out of it. The Supreme Court was involved in it. But I think there's a fundamental difference in the time because of what was going on in the country. It's not quite the same. I know a lot of people want to say it's the same. It's just not quite the same. There were those newsreels that you can never forget of black people being hit with fire hoses and having dogs put on them, and that was being seen on the 6 o'clock news when Ali made his stand. Maybe things have gotten better. Maybe things have stayed the same in some ways, but Ali was up against a hell of a lot more than people are up against today with this kind of thing.
Okay, the title of the film is
Ali and Cavett, The Tale of the Tapes.
14 different interviews.
Yeah, we don't use every one of them, but there's a lot of footage of Dick and Muhammad Ali in the film.
It's a 90-minute movie, so it's at the Siskel Film Center tonight. I've got a couple of tickets for the 8 o'clock screening, and if you want to go, it's otherwise, I believe, sold out. We'll put them and we'll call in your name. Call 312-591-7200, 312-591-7200. And Griff, let's take the 10th caller and we'll leave them in the name of that. I said 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Thank you for that. And Robert, nice to meet you.
Well, thank you. It was a great pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I'll tell Nick DiGilio you said hi,
too. Yeah, tell him I said hi.
He'll be on this station late night. It's 1:58, and the news is next on WGN. All right, thank you, Mr. Bertrand. This is John Williams. It's 2:09. We are in the Allstate Skyline Studio. We are here weekdays until 3, Saturdays from 10 a.m. until 12 noon on social media, WGN King John. You will find on my Facebook page and on our website, WGNradio.com, the daily web poll question that we call the News Click. Today's News Click is about the all-important called third strike against Anthony Rizzo at yesterday's Cubs game. The Cubs weren't playing that well. They were losing. They always come back, though, so even though you say, well, they still lost, what was it, 10-5? You know, what are the chances you guys are going to win? But they'd already scored a run, and, you know, the Cubs can, it seems like, come back from any deficit. So here they were, Anthony Rizzo up to the plate, and he looks at a called third strike, which you just can't do when there's two out, two strikes in the last of the ninth. You've got to protect the plate. And Rizzo stood there with the bat on his shoulder, and he got rung up, and so everybody was outraged, not so much at Anthony, but what a bad call it was. And so we have posted, so who all has seen that video? Violetta, have you seen the video of the called third strike at the end of the Cubs game?
No, I haven't. I'm going to go check it out.
Griffin, you've seen the called third strike at the end of the Cubs game. And I know the correct answer is, that was an outrage. We should be marching in the street. We need to shut down Lakeshore Drive. I thought it was going to be worse. I think that ball looked like a strike until it tailed at the very end. And the pitch tracker thing they have showed that it was, that ball was somewhere down the left field line. It was so outside, right? I mean, that's what their pitch tracker makes it look like. And that thing, I guess, is correct. But it looked to me like it's possible that it clipped the front of the plate and then broke late as it was making its way to the catcher's mitt.
Right. So I'm not a professional in sports, but aren't there a lot of different calls? The game really does not come down to necessarily one ball or strike, or it's a game of numbers, like a lot of them.
Yeah, well, I think you're right about that. And I also think even if it was one pitch in one game on which it all turned, you got 162 games during the season.
Right.
And it's not like we were the bases were loaded and we were down by one. So I think there's a lot of ways to say that was not a big deal. But I'm just wondering if you think that was a strike at all or not. And it might be interesting to also engage on how egregious was that call. But I'm telling you, I was listening to the radio yesterday, and I was listening to the radio this morning, and I was reading about it, and
people are fired up.
I was expecting to see something worse. That's all I'll say. Do I think that was a ball or a strike? On the News Click, I actually voted that it was a strike, but that's just because I can be a pain in the butt sometimes. It was a ball. It was a ball. But I think it was not as bad a call as I thought it was going to be when I saw the video. So you can see it on our webpage.
Right, and like you described it, so if it's a strike, does it have to go from start to finish as a strike, or can it be a ball that turns into a strike?
All it has to do is clip the plate. All it has to do is clip the plate. If it part of it is sailing over the plate and part of it is off the plate, it's a strike. But I know what you're about to say, those of you listening at home and in your cars pounding the dashboards. It never touched the plate. Let's ask Raja Krishnamoorthy about this. He's a noted baseball expert and member of the United States Congress. Congressman Krishnamoorthy, you're on WGN. How are you?
Hey, John. How are you, my friend?
I know we've got a lot to talk about, but did you see the called third strike in the Cubs game yesterday?
I heard and read all about it.
And what is your opinion, sir?
It appeared to be a ball. I understand that Rizzo chased the ump down the line, and he thinks that it's unacceptable for that to be anything other than a ball. But you know, hey, we've got the first place Chicago Cubs poised for greater things. That's what I think.
I don't know that he chased him down the line. Be careful with your verbs there, Mr. Congressman. I think he walked with him, but I don't know that chased is the right word. The two of them have an interesting history. And
they had a saunter. Okay, I understand. They sauntered together down the line discussing baseball and the last call of the game. Yes, I understand.
And I'm going to get back to this after the 2:30 WGN radio news. But one solution, so help me, people are saying, this is a reason that we need to have a machine called the balls and strikes in baseball games. And that will be the day I quit watching baseball, when you have some sort of machine assisting the umpire. I want human beings to call the balls and strikes. Do you feel the same way as I do, Raj?
I do. There might be other ways to bring some technology into the game, but I think that human element, makes baseball what it is.
Congressman, you were in the presence of the president the other day, were you not?
I was, yes.
Tell me about this piece of legislation that he signed.
I think I've told your listeners and you many times before that my passion in this Congress has been modernizing our career technical and vocational education system in this country.
Yep.
It hasn't been updated in 12 years since before the iPhone was invented. And so that was my bill, along with Congressman G.T. Thompson, a Republican. And, of course, I'm a Democrat. So we've been pushing for 2 years, and we finally got it through the Senate 2 weeks ago, and then got it through the House one last time, and then last Tuesday, President Trump signed it into law. And
what does
really
the bill say? What does this do?
Yeah, three things. One, it increases resources modestly so that more students can participate in career, technical, and vocational education programs throughout the country. Secondly, it shifts authority for spending this money from Washington to state and local high schools and community college districts. And then third, it does something really important, which is make sure that businesses and employers are at the table to help validate the skills that are taught, so that these young folks and others in career transition can get access to what I call the greatest anti-poverty program devised by human beings, a J-O-B, a job. We want them to get a job. And, two-thirds of Americans aren't going to get a four-year college degree, but we have to do everything possible to make sure they have a path into the middle class. And in my humble opinion, it involves career technical and vocational education.
So what are we talking about, welding, or are we talking about computer science here?
Everything. So it's fascinating, John, how the types of skills being taught in these programs run the gamut from welding and carpentry to cybersecurity and solar panel installation and, basically claims analysis at insurance companies and everything in between. So it's no longer just, one type of profession or another. It's everything. But the main point is that it allows people to get a credential or a certification or those skills that are required to get jobs. And as you know, a lot of the fields in the past that may not have required these types of certifications and skill sets do so now, because they involve computers, some automation, and some knowledge of computing and mathematics that perhaps a generation ago they may not have.
Congressman Raja Krishnamurthy is on the phone line. So are the kids learning these skills, or are they supposed to learn these in high school, or would this be like at a junior college setting after high school?
Both. It can be. Actually, the very interesting part of this bill that think is very important is that you get introduced to a lot of different professions career and technical education as early as fifth grade if you're interested in them. That allows for career exploration so that people don't necessarily make up their minds that X, Y, or Z may not be for them without having had some exposure to them. I'll just give you an example. Manufacturing jobs oftentimes are thought to be, dirty jobs, grimy jobs, jobs that, you don't want to be doing if you can avoid them. But actually, a lot of times nowadays, they are in clean rooms, they are in spaces that are spick and span and that require quite a bit of sophistication, and they pay extremely well.
My understanding is that actually manufacturing you know, companies that build things or do the whole range you're talking about, right? Plumbing and carpentry all the way to computer science or solar panel installation. But they are not finding enough qualified people to fill those positions. Am I right about that?
You're 100% correct about that. It's called a skills gap. There are 6.5 million jobs in the current workforce, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, for whom employers cannot find workers with the skills or experience necessary to fill them. And so it's all the more reason that we basically equip people with the skills to take those jobs. That means filling that skills gap.
So you got a piece of legislation passed by both houses, signed by the president into law, and at the end of the day, we're going to increase funding for these kinds of programs, so maybe more tools in the school or teachers to teach these things, is that it?
That's right. So, for instance, Illinois is going to get additional resources. I had a phone call with the Illinois superintendent of schools who was just ecstatic about it because, as you know, it's not like schools in Illinois, especially public schools, are rolling in dough. They are doing the best they can with what they have, but some additional resources to invest in these programs means two things. One, introducing more of these types of courses to more students, but also mainstreaming some of these courses so that even people who may end up, you know, going to a four-year college and getting a four-year college degree are exposed to some of these other professions.
Yeah.
So that they too can learn, hey, you know, that light bulb might go off one day where they're in that carpentry class or they're in that, you know, cybersecurity class or whatever, and they're like, wow, this is what I want to do. It's not what I anticipated, but it's something that, you know, I'm passionate about. I can see myself doing in the future, and I'm just so excited about that. The other thing I just want to mention very quickly is that it's not just that this program is going to have additional federal dollars, but I believe it's going to unleash private dollars sitting on the sidelines waiting for, you know, the rules of the road to have been written in the way that they have been as part of this law to then pour into the system and basically allow for greater leveraging of those federal dollars. So you have, you know, the Boeings and the Caterpillars and the John Deeres and the Allstates and other companies basically pouring money in. I can even name some downtown, Aon and Accenture and others who are already doing apprenticeship programs and other things that are going very well, by the way, who might be able to now partner with other community colleges and do even more. So it puts these programs on steroids. It adds more resources so they can expand.
When I was in high school 55, 60,000 years ago, the sorts of classes we had like this were shop class for the boys, home ec for the girls. There were some clerical classes that were taught too. It always felt like a sort of academic consolation round for the kids who didn't get good grades or weren't going to go on to college. And I think if we looked at that instead as a proactive sort of thing, like, hey, wouldn't it be great if we taught you the skills to be good at this rather than just throw this in there because you can't do that over there? And if we expanded it, which is obviously what we're doing, it would be better for everybody. And shoot, if you're a plumber, a carpenter, I presume if you're in the solar business or the computer business, you're probably going to have just as optimistic a career future as those people who have college degrees. I mean, the joke for a lot of us is, right, the plumber's making more than I am, and I got a degree in accounting or whatever it is. So I don't think there's any reason not to equip young people with those sorts of skills. But you know what I heard one time? That there are more straight-A students in India than there are students in the United States. I have two questions for you, Raj. We'll pause and come back. One is, are we sort of neglecting then the need to teach kids the three R's when we do something like this? And what was your interaction with the president like? Did he hold up your bill and sign it and show it to everybody? And just take me inside that little bubble in a minute. Raja Krishnamurthy, the Chicago area congressman, is on a phone line. He's a Democrat, got a bipartisan bill passed from both houses. The president signed it into law, and it's going to increase the funding for, exactly how do you describe it, increase the, finish that sentence for me, Raj, funding for?
career technical education programs. At one time, they were called vocational education, and in some places, they still are.
I asked you two questions before the break.
Yes.
One was reliance on, and I, you know, we're a little short of time here, but talk to me about that kind of pursuit versus academic pursuit in school.
First of all, I just want to touch on something you mentioned before, which is we cannot stigmatize people who decide to pursue these professions, and I think sometimes that's done, and it's really done at our peril, because what we're doing is we're basically creating a skills gap that that prevents our economy from functioning properly and take and going to the next height, so to speak. The other thing is, with regard to making sure that students are remain well-rounded and so forth, I think we certainly want to make sure people know their three R's, as you mentioned before. But what I'm concerned about is that people are not getting the skills to get a job. And, you know, you see so many people even after college graduation who may end up in a profession or a job that in which they're underemployed or not, they're not able to really you know, find their calling, so to speak. So really what we're trying to do here is to allow for more people to you know, land where, you know, their potential lies, whatever profession, regardless of the job it is.
I think that's well put. I'm glad you said that. 60 seconds. Tell me what it was like at the bill signing. What was your interaction with the president like?
Oh, it was somewhat brief. I think that you know, I haven't been shy about being critical about the president's policies on so many issues, from immigration to Russia to the environment and so forth. However, I was just glad that we could come together on workforce development issues, and specifically on this particular bill. I think it is significant. It's going to help a lot of people.
I guess you got to pick your spots, right? So you've got his ear. You're sitting right there. It might be tempting to say something to him or push back. No, I'm serious, but I guess maybe you think that might be counterproductive in the long run for your own agenda.
Well, I think that you know, the interaction was somewhat brief, and it was really about this particular bill. And I did want to keep the attention on the substance of this bill,
right?
Because quite frankly, it doesn't get enough attention in general compared to some other topics. And yet, I feel like this is something where our work has just begun. Because, as I said, you know, 2/3 of Americans are not going to get a 4-year college degree. They deserve every chance, as much as anyone else, to have a path into the middle class. And I feel like that's where career technical education can really be a game changer.
Our Thomas Jefferson show is coming up in a couple of Saturdays. I'm looking forward to seeing you there.
Yes, sir.
Stand up and ask the third president a question as well.
Thank you. I have some questions.
That'll be fun. Thanks, Raj.
Thank you, sir.
Rajah Krishnamurthy, the Chicago area congressman. Steve's got the news. That's next here on WGN. Thank you, Steve Bertrand. This is John Williams. Steve, what was the funnest thing you did over the weekend?
The funnest thing? Well, I cleaned the garage yesterday. Oh, I went to the Metropolitan Brewery along the river there. I think south of Belmont, Rockwell. That was
okay.
Fun.
The second one was better than the first.
Yeah.
Just so you know.
Mm-hmm.
We went and saw Mission Impossible.
What was the best thing you did this weekend, John?
I saw Mission Impossible.
You liked it?
Swam in the lake. It was too hot yesterday for my wife and I and the dumb dogs to do the things we would have otherwise done, so it was kind of a weird day.
And it was a very long day yesterday. Same thing. I cleaned the garage by 10 a.m., and then I mowed the yard at like 7:30 in the evening because I just...
In between, you said no.
Didn't want to go out.
Happened. Yeah.
I went day drinking on Saturday.
Well, is that different from other Saturdays?
Yeah, kind of. They started earlier than usual.
I've only recently bumped into that phenomena. Hey, let's go day drinking.
It's a thing, because you need to nap afterwards, especially if you're going to go out after.
People of a certain generation, say mine, live their lives like this. Work hard. Do the garage, do the lawn, do the things you got to do. Then at night, as a sort of reward or respite, you then go out and have a couple of cocktails or a six-pack, whatever it is that you're going to do. There's another way to approach it, and that is, how about if on a weekend day we just go out to lunch and start cranking a little bit and just go that way all day until we then fall asleep earlier rather than later.
Well, but then they get up and go out again. The generation
yes, they do.
The generation before us used to do that. They called it a business lunch.
They really did.
By the way, I got a text. I'm supposed to point out that I mowed the lawn with my new lawnmower purchased from the Edgebrook Ace Hardware store.
I wonder who could have texted that into you.
Some guy Ace named... is the place with the helpful hardware.
It was very cool, too. I was very happy. I didn't even need it because it's been so dry, but...
Lou Manfredini just texted you, right?
Yeah, of course.
Name drop.
He's a listener.
I did adult things this weekend. I watered my lawn. We got some fresh sod.
Oh, yeah, you got to get on that, son.
Ooh, this is a bad time. What were you thinking?
What do you mean it's a bad time?
To put sod down?
I don't know. My roommate got it. He's out of town. He called me. He's like, dude, I didn't know the guy was coming, but he laid the sod, water it every day. I'm like, done.
And how many beers did you have while you watered the lawn?
I like watering. Watering's fun. I'm serious. I like
too.
It. It's relaxing.
I actually take some time, and I don't know how my new condo mates feel about this. We're in an 8-flat, so I'll run the hose out of the garage, up the driveway, and then over to the front of our building, and I'll water the plants and the planter. And my neighbor isn't doing a real good job keeping his lawn wet, so I'm watering his yard as well.
I don't think you're supposed to do that.
And
I wish I could see this. John's like sneakily.
Just whip the hose over there once.
Well, I squirt it in a long shot, and I can get the front of his yard, and I'm watering back and forth. And I'm half of the time doing so looking at the door of our unit, because if somebody comes out, I quick put the hose over on our stuff, because I don't want them thinking I'm spending their money watering the neighbor's lawn.
Which you're doing.
Here's why I do that. We all have to walk past their lawn every day. What would you rather see, a nice green patch of grass or some dirt and rocks? I would rather see some green grass. So I think you can justify watering somebody else's lawn because you will appreciate it as you walk by.
Okay, you've been all about the ecosystem and the recycling and all of that, right?
Oh, Steve, coming in.
Isn't it natural that grass would go brown at this time of year and you should just let it go? I'm axing.
Well, since I also, this lawn that I'm talking about that I'm hit with the water from the neighbors is a lawn that I happen to plant as well. I went over when they weren't looking.
Yeah.
And I scraped everything off, leveled it out, and then I planted grass seed in the neighbor's yard.
You don't really mean that, do you?
I 100% mean that.
So when you mean neighbors, they're still in your complex?
No, it's a different building.
You're going to be putting new siding on the on the building this weekend?
Again, I have to walk, literally.
Paint the front door.
You walk up and down some of the streets and you go, nice lawn, maintained. Nice flowers, maintained. Oh, this is garbage.
You planted grass seed in the next building without, so did you get any approval?
I did not tell them.
Such a dad move. This is something my dad would do.
After the show, you go into Lollapalooza to Grant Park to clean up a little
right.
bit.
Look at the mess these kids made. He's got a garbage
You better watch
bag.
It. He might bring you with him.
Well, they trampled that grass so hard, you don't want to see that. I don't like the way that looks.
I'm surprised more people aren't like me. And I suspect, listening to this, you feel like, yeah, John, go, boy. We should be like you.
You say surprised. I'm kind of grateful.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I just don't want people doing
my
yard.
Lawn.
Well, see, that's the thing. I've thought this through because that's what I do. And I thought, okay, I know that you shouldn't be messing with other people's stuff, but really, did they like the dirt and rocks they had in front of their building, or would they like a patch of grass?
Maybe worth asking them.
That's a good question, John.
Yeah, I don't think that. And by the way,
I sure don't have the answer to that one, but they might.
And if you are that person who said, hey, I've got an 8-flat next to your 8-flat, and on our 8-flat, we thought rocks, dirt, sticks, and cigarette butts would be a nice look. If you're that person, you're wrong. That's a bad look. You don't really want that.
This is a very Larry David moment. You're going to be standing out there observing your neighbor's lawn that you planted and watered.
Yeah.
And they're going to come on and be like, God, this jerk. He came by, put down the sod.
How could they possibly feel that way?
Or he'll be upset because they didn't thank him.
Right.
You know, they'll be having their block party on their little 4x4 piece of grass.
And they didn't even notice.
Yeah, John will be standing out there.
It is like that. It's about a 4x18 foot patch of grass. It's just a couple of postage stamps out there.
See, if you got a small, like, city front lawn like that, you should be taking care of it.
See, I think the opposite. It's so small and insignificant.
No, you should have a flush, nice, green lawn.
My family has never
kept up. Our place is almost on a full acre of land. So, like, if we have some dead spots,
no,
it's a little more understandable.
Yeah, no, this is it. All you've got in your whole world is to maintain, you know, 100 square feet of grass. Maybe not even that. So I'm thinking, okay, if you won't, I will. And here's the problem now.
Are you going to suggest a special assessment so they can get new windows?
I love this.
I now have to mow that lawn because they ain't going to mow it either. And it's grown well enough that I now got to get the mower over there and mow it.
Have you ever peeked in their windows and seen, do you like the way it looks inside? Maybe you could get in there and rearrange some furniture or something?
You guys could use some fresh paint in there.
Wait, I want you to put up a please stay off the grass sign in your neighbor's yard.
Or like pick up, like we're watching, pick up the dog too.
Right.
So the reason I'm doing this.
Play like your children live here.
Just to go back to the beginning is because we all share that view. It's not just me, the neighbor. It's the community. It's them. And sure, they should do it. But I'm going to do it because I think we'll all benefit from it.
And that's what makes you King John.
Hard to argue with that, is it?
I'm okay with it, actually. I just love the whole idea of you doing this.
So just to finish the story, and I know you're enjoying this, I was recently watering their lawn and picking up some sticks, and a woman came by, and she and I were kind of visiting, and she revealed to me that she was the owner of that building.
The whole building?
Yeah, the building that I'm doing all of this.
So it's a rental?
Yeah.
Okay.
And she doesn't live there, but she rents out the three floors. And so I said, yeah. And I thought I'd kind of crow a little bit. I said, I went ahead and smoothed that out and put some grass there. And she said, well, I liked the way it was. I wanted it to be kind of a hill, like a berm in the middle, and then dirt on the sides. I was eventually going to put some plants there, but the plants don't grow and the dogs pee on it, so I was going to leave it that way. And I could tell that I thought where I was going to get this sort of congratulatory thing, I didn't get it from her. And then I said, you know, I power washed the sidewalks around the buildings too, and that's also the truth. And she said, oh, you're the one that pushed all of the crap around our building. And I said, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't realize that, but I just thought I'd get everything nice and clean because it wasn't that clean.
Mm-hmm.
And
so these aren't technically hints.
So here's the moral of the story, though, and this is a wonderful human dynamic I'm about to share with you. Where previously, not knowing who had done all of that inadvertent maintenance to her property, she was unhappy. She like didn't like that somebody was messing with her stuff. She and I were having a real nice chat. And over the course of that chat, I revealed that I was this sort of mystery maintainer. And then she said, and this is a beautiful thing, I was angry about this until I met you. You seem like a nice guy. Now I'm not angry about it. Well, isn't that an interesting sort of thing that just happened there?
Right. Maybe she's a little afraid of you. Have you gotten a protection order yet?
So what we've learned is that when you sort of just break that human barrier and say, hey, you know, you're a guy, I'm a guy. It's like when you're trying to cut into traffic and you wave down, you roll down the window and make eye contact with that person. Give them a friendly wave. Hey, could you let me in? I'm in the wrong lane. I screwed up. When you do that, when you become a human being and not a car, when you become a nice neighbor and not just another unit, all of the barriers fall down.
Technically, I think to live up to your example, you would have had to have cut the car off at a high speed and then waved.
That's not what this was.
It's kind of what it was. You did the lawn and then you didn't even still ask.
I paid for the grass seed myself.
Oh.
Well, actually, I had a neighbor once. They redid the flower plants in our corner of the building that we have.
Well, hello.
Very nice, right? Taped the receipt for everything that she did on the door.
Oh, my. Now, that's a little passive-aggressive.
Dad paid her. And I was like, no, this is unacceptable.
Oh, no.
She took it upon herself to do that.
Oh, no. I don't know. I don't think that.
Isn't that crazy?
That's not even a good deed. That's just sort of, you're just like hiring yourself out. That's not the plan.
Yeah, it was something.
Gene, you're on WGN. Hi, welcome to the show.
John, your story is just affirmation of why the world loves you. And you and Steve, though, could do a dog and pony show on their own, just entertain and then have Violetta when she's got time and she's not too busy. You two are quite an act. I actually couldn't stand. We had a neighbor, and I don't remember if it predates or postdates 9/11, put out an American flag, attached to a thing attached to the garage. And years went by, and the thing was practically in shreds. It looked terrible, and I knew, even though I've never been a boy or Girl Scout, that you're not supposed to have them out there if they're And I said, the flag committee came through the neighborhood, and they're giving out flags to people who have flags that need to be replaced.
Yeah.
It got done. There was no argument. And, you know, honest to God, I just don't think if you leave this place a brighter, this world a brighter place than you found it.
Who paid for that flag,
though? That's got to be a good thing.
Gene, who paid for that flag, then? You did, right?
Of course I did, yeah.
God bless you and your family. Thank you for listening, Gene. Thank you for the call. It's nice of you to listen. I appreciate all the kind words. Tom, you're on WGN. What did you want to say? You're on the air.
Yes, good afternoon, King John. I've got a daughter. As soon as you were putting out the scenario, I've got a daughter that lives in Bucktown, Wicker Park area.
Yeah.
And her place is nice, but it's not, the front end wasn't burnt grass and rock, as you were alluding to, but it was all overgrown, nasty weeds and whatever. And she finally, one weekend, got tired of looking at it, pulled all the weeds, leveled it all off, put the permeable membrane down, and put some nice-looking mulch down.
Wow.
And then went ahead and did the back of the building, and the landlord saw it, and now the landlord gives her X amount off every month now. He liked what she did.
Now, that's the thing. I don't exactly understand all of this indifference. I don't know that it's money. Maybe it's time and effort. But so in this case, they were happy to have it done, and they discount the rent to kind of compensate her for the expense, huh?
Exactly, exactly. Oh, it worked out really good. Win-win situation.
How about that? God bless you. You raised your right. You're a good man there, Tom.
Thank you, thank you.
Thanks for the phone call. None of that has happened in my case, and I don't. That's certainly not my motivation, Your Honor. It's 251-312-981-7200 is how you call or text. Joining the conversation, Terry, you're on WGN. What did you want to say? Hi.
Hello, John. Well, my first question is, hey, any interest in moving to Madison, Wisconsin and being my neighbor? we have three neighbors, one on each side, one behind, and I don't think any of them put a dime into any kind of lawn care. One side is really negligent, and my wife keeps telling me to stop pulling weeds in their yard that butts up against each other, because she goes, you don't know that, but he's got a 5-foot-tall thistle plant going around. I'm real close to pulling out of the ground.
No, that's not good. That's not good.
You know, yeah, they just don't even pull obvious weeds out of there and trim up some area. So there's a bunch of them like that, and I volunteer with Neighbor Association and take care of about 4 or 5 different gardens that we have in the neighborhood area, and medians and so forth, and that's plenty of work, but just having a neighbor that really clean up and take care of, you know, weeds in the grass and stuff that just blow over to your yard would be sure would be nice.
Yeah, well, that's nice of you to say. And nobody's called in to say that I did something like this and it went badly. Maybe there's those stories. Maybe you can text that and we'll pick it up again tomorrow. We're about out of time today. Thanks for the call, Terry, up in Madison. But my guess is most people are probably a little embarrassed and happy to have somebody else do the work. And if they don't like the way you did it, the other neighbor, I mowed their lawn, and I think I may have cut the grass a little too close. But, you know, it's better than nothing. And that wraps it up for today. By the way, the news click at WGNradio.com is about the ball strike call at the end of the Cubs game. Kevin, I got 19 seconds for you. Was that a ball or a strike?
Oh, it was a ball by a mile. That was an atrocious call. Anthony Rizzo said all the right things after the game.
Boy, he was real stand-up about it.
Mm-hmm.
And the two of them have a history in the NLCS in 2016. Well, it would have been the NLCS in 2016. Rizzo called him out, and then in the next at bat, after he had a chance to look at it, Rizzo came
apologized.
Up to the umpire and apologized. Mm-hmm. And then the umpire goes, hey, you're a good guy. You're great. That's okay. You know, we're all competitive here. I understand. So they had a real nice working relationship, those two.
Yeah, Angel Hernandez blew that one yesterday afternoon.
Yeah. You like the idea of machines calling balls and strikes?
They'll get it right. I just love the human element. Is maddening as it can be sometimes. I'm all for less technology in sports, actually.
I am, too. I don't even like replays, to be honest with you.
It's something. It's a lot to digest. It slows down games. Yes, it gets the call right some of the time. Some of the times, I think they get the call right, and then the umpires or officials in football, baseball, whatever it may be, they overanalyze, and they convince themselves they got it wrong, and they change it into an incorrect call.
Well, that's the thing, because really, so machines helping... It's still, a lot of times, humans have to see, like, what did the instant replay say? And then it's still a judgment call.
Right.
And the slowing down of the game, I'm surprised the athletes don't complain more. The news click at WGNradio.com is asking you about that call. We're heading into Studio A now. That's where Ro Khan and Anna DeVlantis are all set up. Hi, guys. At least they should be all set up about now. You guys talking over there, Ro and Anna? It looks like they are...
Here.
Now they're ready.
Yes,
how are you, Ro Khan?
We couldn't be better. We're preparing ourselves. Gary McCarthy's going to join us coming up in this hour.
Which one?
Not Jerry.
Okay, because...
Gary.
I wondered which one, because there's a lot of Gary McCarthy's out there. There's one with one R.
Yes.
There's one with two R's. There's a Jerry McCarthy.
There is.
Yes. Jenny McCarthy.
Yes. Totally different.
I think if you get a McCarthy in, it's a win. Yeah. It really doesn't matter.
A lot of good McCarthys to talk to.
And so this is the Gary McCarthy that was the police superintendent, now wants to be mayor.
What's your answer to this question? Does Giuliani / Trump's endorsement help or hurt his campaign in Chicago?
Well, it's not really technically Trump's endorsement yet, is it?
I think when Giuliani's throwing that stuff out there, where do you think that's coming from?
Well, Giuliani, because he's mayor of New York.
I know that.
McCarthy was a boss in New York at the time. So there's that. But he also doesn't seem to be that familiar with him. So.
I know. You call him by the wrong first name.
He says the policing genius, like, oh, wow, you must really know this guy's work. And then he can't get his name. He's misspelled Rahm Emanuel twice, too. So
yeah. I would say that does it help him or hurt him in Chicago?
That's my question.
I will answer it this way. Gary McCarthy has shied away from saying that he accepts Donald Trump's, you know, endorsement. Let's put it this way. He doesn't want to associate Donald Trump with his campaign, or hasn't previously wanted to. I don't know if that's going to change now, but when people say, well, what about Trump? He goes, I don't want to talk about that. This is not about national politics. It's about Chicago. Has been his answer to this. So I think he wants to be on a separate... has at least traditionally wanted to be on a separate wavelength politically. Now, I will say this. If you were to embrace it, I don't think it helps him in Chicago.
I think you're right about that.
I mean, it certainly in the... I mean, would Donald Trump bring out 3%, 2% of the black community and of the Spanish language community, however you want to break that out, whether it's Puerto Ricans or Mexicans, which is, you know, the two dominant, you know, Mexicans, you know, by far the dominant Hispanic community in Chicago, and then Puerto Ricans at about 20%, 15-20%. Neither of them have a good experience thus far with Donald Trump, so they're not going to come out. So I would say that now you are down to, this is a game to get to the final two.
Yeah, no question.
And I think that would not help Gary McCarthy get to the final
two. What time's he coming on?
3:40.
Okay, I'm going to get out of the way. You guys have a good show.